Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello and welcome back to Key Battles of the War of 1812. This is your host, James Early, as always. And as always, I have Steve Guerra with me to help me out to get through this interesting story of the northern part of the War of 1812. Steve, how you doing, sir?
I'm great. I'm ready to get into this. I've got my sea legs back on again. We keep switching land to sea.
That's right. Yes, it's an interesting war because there is so much naval combat and even combat on the Great Lakes. And we're going to be talking about that a lot today. We're also going to look at some political and economic events toward the end of the episode. So in our last episode, we saw that the Americans made a second attempt to invade Canada in three places. And basically, they were 1-for-3. So their batting average was .333. That's pretty good if you're an actual professional baseball player, but it's not very good if you're trying to wage a war. They were successful in recapturing Detroit and even pushing into Upper Canada in the Northwest frontier, the Northwest Theater, if you will. But on the Niagara front, they made a few initial gains, but then were pushed right back out of Canada by the British. And then they tried to attack Montreal, and that was an utter failure. So in this episode, let's see what's going to happen on the water. What do you think? Where should we start?
Yeah, getting back into the when we left off, that the Navy, the U.S. Navy, had all these big wins, and now they're trying to reinvest in, or maybe invest in the first time for a proper Navy. What was going on with all of that now?
Yeah, so I'll review something I said at the end of our last naval episode. In late 1812 and early 1813, the U.S. Congress authorized the building of several new warships, including 4 74-gun ships of the line. That was new. The Americans had not had any ships of the line. Those are the equivalents of battleships, huge monster vessels. They also authorized the building of 6 44-gun frigates. And as I also said, at the same time, the British Naval High Command dispatched more warships to North America. But keeping these fully manned was always a challenge because large numbers of British seamen deserted as soon as they stepped onto American soil. British overall naval commander Admiral Warren had a very difficult task. As Ian B. Toll, he's a naval historian who wrote a great book called Six Frigates, The Epic History of the Founding of the U.S. Navy. Toll writes this, quote, "Warren was expected to achieve several different objectives simultaneously. Hunt the American frigates, patrol the sea lanes against an armada of American privateers, provide convoys for British merchantmen sailing home from the West Indies, and maintain a commercial blockade." Sounds pretty easy to me. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, simple.
Oh, yeah, that's a tall order. The British blockade did grow increasingly effective as the war progressed, and as a result, there were not as many naval engagements in 1813 as there had been in 1812, at least on the blue water, on the open ocean. And that's for the simple reason that most American ships were unable to leave port. American ships that did succeed in leaving port usually could not find victims. And due to the many American naval victories in 1812, the British Admiralty had ordered British warships to begin sailing in squadrons. In addition, merchantmen had begun traveling in convoys. American ships were ordered to sail separately and to avoid battle, except under the most favorable circumstances. 1813 saw only four duels between American and British ships, and three of them were British victories.
We had been talking about something, and you mentioned that you read something really interesting about something called the Torpedo Act. That sounds like a fun fact, Torpedo Act.
Yeah, it's fascinating. This is something I'd never even heard of prior to doing my research for this series, but I got this from Ian Toll's book that I just mentioned. The Torpedo Act was passed by Congress in March 1813, and it made it lawful for, quote, any person or persons to burn, sink, or destroy any British armed vessels of war, and for that purpose to use torpedoes, submarine instruments, or any other destructive machines, whatever. Now, I should clarify that the word torpedo in the 19th century didn't mean what we think of. When we think of a torpedo, we think of a kind of a missile that gets under the water and it's fired and it goes a long distance and attacks another ship. But a torpedo is, back in this time, was what we would today call a mine, just a stationary object. So basically any American, whether they were civilian or military, who could sink an enemy warship by such means would be paid a federal bounty equivalent to half the value of the vessel destroyed.
Wow.
So isn't that interesting? It makes anybody that wants to, just any Joe on the street, if they can come up with a torpedo, blow up a British ship, they get a paycheck.
And that couldn't cause any problems at all.
Oh, no, not a, yes, right. One of the best known people who tried to invent one of these torpedoes was Robert Fulton, who famously also invented or at least perfected the steam engine. There were several examples of attempts to torpedo some of these British ships. There was one on July 4th where a floating mine approached the HMS Plantagenet, but it detonated prematurely at a range of 100 yards, throwing up a huge column of flame and water. There were other attacks. I won't go into a lot of detail to save time. There really weren't any major victories or successes with this. This is sometimes called the Torpedo War. It did not really accomplish what the U.S. government had hoped it would, but it did serve to embitter the conflict considerably. The British saw this as ungentlemanly. They saw this as really dirty pool.
But even beyond that, when you're making, it's pretty much irregular warfare, and you're putting citizens in the line of fire, which has always been kind of verboten in warfare.
Yes, definitely.
Let's move on to the high seas and one of these really fun and, I mean, not fun for the people involved, but fun for us sitting in our armchairs 200 years later, a big naval duel between two big ships.
Yes, it's fun to read about. And this is the famous one-on-one battle, the Chesapeake, which we talked about the Chesapeake way back in our first episode. This was the ship that had been fired on by the British. Well, it's back. And in May of 1813, Captain James Lawrence, who had captained previously the U.S. sloop Hornet, he had achieved a victory as the commander of the Hornet over the HMS Peacock. Both of these had 20 guns. So because of his victory, he was given a promotion and he's put in command of the frigate Chesapeake. Many of Lawrence's officers and seamen were inexperienced and could have used a training cruise, but the aggressive Lawrence was eager to get the ship into battle. Outside of Boston, where the Chesapeake was docked when Lawrence took command of it, patrolled two British frigates, the Shannon with 52 guns and the Tenedos, which was about 47 guns or so. The Shannon's commander, Captain Philip Broke, was a gifted and veteran officer who had commanded the Shannon since 1806. One British officer wrote this, quote, "The Shannon's men were better trained and understood gunnery better than any men I ever saw," end quote. So when Captain Broke, the British captain of the Shannon, learned that the Chesapeake was about to sail, he ordered the Tenedos away, and he sent a challenge to Lawrence, asking for a ship-to-ship duel. So this is this chivalry of just one-on-one. Like, he wants it to be a fair fight, the British commander. He wants to just, you know, you and me, skill against skill. But Lawrence did not need this challenge. He wanted it badly. He had already set sail and was heading toward the Shannon. Now, the Chesapeake was flying a flag that said free trade and sailors' rights. That was one of the early American slogans, one of the reasons we were fighting, so that the British wouldn't harass American ships. The Chesapeake sails toward the Shannon, and soon the two ships were side by side and began firing broadsides at close range. The Shannon's superior gunnery caused tremendous damage to the Chesapeake. Before long, sailors and Marines from the Shannon boarded the Chesapeake. Captain Lawrence was mortally wounded in the fight. He kept telling his crew members, "Don't give up the ship. Don't give up the ship." But eventually they had no choice but to surrender. They did, in fact, give up the ship. The Shannon took the Chesapeake as a prize to Halifax. Later, she was broken up for scrap lumber, the ultimate humiliation for a warship. And the battle between the Chesapeake and the Shannon, which lasted only 15 minutes, would prove to be the bloodiest sea battle of the entire war. The British suffered 23 killed and 56 wounded, including Captain Broke, while the Americans lost 48 killed, including Captain Lawrence, 99 wounded, and 232 captured. 100 of the American casualties occurred in the first 2 minutes of the battle. Can you imagine that, Steve? Just
unbelievable.
Utter terror, just chaos and bloodshed and blood and guts flying around and heads being blown off and arms being knocked off and splinters going everywhere and grape shot and canister. Just, oh, absolute hell. The Shannon's victory over the Chesapeake, which was the first defeat of an American frigate in the war, greatly boosted British morale. Broke was a national hero. Ian Toll writes this, quote, "The Royal Navy's honor was saved, and the world that had been turned upside down in those few disturbing months of 1812 had at last rotated back to its right side up," close quote. In the U.S., despite the loss of the Chesapeake, Captain Lawrence was celebrated as a hero, and his friend, Captain Oliver Hazard Perry, that we'll talk about in just a few minutes, he named one of his ships after Lawrence. And "Don't give up the ship" became the U.S. Navy's rallying cry. And in fact, people still say that today.
Don't you think that "Don't give up the ship" has a little bit more ring to it than "Remember the Raisin"?
"Remember the Raisin," yeah. I don't know. Yes, it does. It definitely does. "Remember the Raisin" is one of these slogans that's forgotten today. Yeah, it's named after a river, obviously, but I can't help thinking of these little dried up former grapes, right? Raisins. I think of the food raisin. But anyway, yes, "Don't give up the ship." The U.S. now had a rallying cry.
These naval battles on the high seas, they seem more like moral victories than and self-esteem victories, more than things that are actually doing anything to the battle and to the war in general. Is that going to change, or where are we at maybe in the sea battle on the high seas?
Well, these one-on-one ship combats are going to eventually peter out because, as I mentioned earlier, the blockade that the British are putting on the American coast gets better and better. And pretty soon, most of the American warships are going to be bottled up in port. They just can't get out safely. But I agree with you. These are not obviously gigantic sea battles like the Battle of Jutland or the Battle of Midway or something like that. They're not these huge game-changing battles with hundreds or even dozens of ships. I mean, it's one-on-one. So regardless of who wins, what happens? One enemy ship is destroyed or taken as a prize. So it's just ship by ship.
Now we swing back into the, I don't know if they have a name for fighting on freshwater, but we'll make one up. We're back on the freshwater battle. What's going on back in the Great Lakes?
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, so we talked about Captain Chauncey, who was the overall American commander of the Great Lakes squadrons, which, as we saw, were not much to speak of at the beginning of the war. But Chauncey needs some help, and so he brings Captain Oliver Hazard Perry over. In late 1812, he puts him in command of all American naval forces on Lake Erie. Chauncey remains in command on Lake Ontario. Let's talk about Perry. He was born in Connecticut in 1785, and he came from a long line of accomplished naval men from both sides of his family. He joined the Navy as a midshipman at the age of 13. Can you imagine this little 13-year-old kid as an officer going around giving orders? Things were so different back then. And like many other American naval commanders of the War of 1812, Perry fought in the Quasi-War and the campaign against the Barbary Pirates. In 1809, he was given command of the USS Revenge, which 2 years later was wrecked. A court-martial absolved Perry of responsibility. He was given an extended leave of absence, which ended when war broke out in 1812. Okay, so he's heading out to Niagara. He arrives there in late March of 1813. And by then, the U.S. had 5 warships at Black Rock, near modern-day Buffalo, and 4 under construction 100 miles away at Presque Isle, which is modern-day Erie, Pennsylvania. After many difficulties, Perry assembled the entire Lake Erie fleet at Presque Isle and got them ready for war. He took command of the Lawrence, which, as I said, was named after his friend, Captain Lawrence, who died in the previous battle we mentioned. And Perry gave command of the Niagara to Lieutenant Jesse Elliott. And both of these had 20 guns. So we're not talking huge ships. Perry had 9 total vessels under his command. The British, on the other hand, only had 6 ships on Lake Erie. They were under the command of Commander Robert Barclay. Even worse for the British, the weight of their broadside was 494 to 912 the American ships. So we're talking the American ships are going to be able to put out double the weight, the poundage of lead that the British can. That's going to be critical. Barclay was also short on supplies, especially food. To open up his supply line, he needed to clear the lake of American ships. So he's going to try to do just that. On September 10th, Barclay sailed toward the American fleet. Perry, the American commander, seeing them coming, flew a flag with the words, "Don't give up the ship." Yes, he actually made a big flag that says, "Don't give up the ship." And he closed the distance while Elliot, his second in command in the Niagara, stayed behind at a long range. And that's an act that caused controversy. And some of the sources I read even accuse Elliot of treason or treachery. Maybe not treason, that's strong, but Elliot was supposed to be right by Perry and he didn't do it. But it's going to work out okay, as we'll see. The Lawrence traded broadsides with the 2 largest British ships, and all 3 vessels took great damage. Perry's crew suffered 80% casualties. That is just, that's almost everybody. Despite this, he refused to surrender the ship. And instead, Perry gets on a boat and he transfers to the Niagara. He makes this dramatic boat ride while, shots are flying through the air and people are trying to pick him off. So instead of surrendering, he just moves to another ship. Then, assuming command of the Niagara, Perry sailed toward the British fleet. Within 3 hours, the two largest British ships had been destroyed. Four had struck their colors, and two others tried to escape but were captured. And in this battle, which came to be known as the Battle of Lake Erie, the Americans suffered 125 casualties, mostly on the Lawrence, to 135 for the British. So Perry gets a complete and utter victory, just through dogged perseverance, refusal to give up. And he sent a message to General Harrison, who was still in command in the West at this time. And it's a very famous statement that has become kind of part of American military lore. He said, "We have met the enemy and they are ours. Two ships, two brigs, one schooner and one sloop." The Battle of Lake Erie clearly and obviously greatly raised American morale. Perry was celebrated across the nation. The historian Henry Adams later wrote, quote, "More than any other battle of the time, the victory on Lake Erie was won by the courage and obstinacy of a single man," end quote. Donald Hickey writes that the battle, quote, "changed the balance of power in the West and enabled the United States to recover all that it had lost in 1812, end quote. Around the same time, there were no decisive contests in the struggle for control of Lake Ontario, and neither side gained firm control of the lake. But that's okay, because now the Americans control Lake Erie overwhelmingly, and that's going to have a huge effect on their ability to conduct a land war. As we already saw, it was a big help to General Harrison as he marched into Upper Canada and won the Battle of the Thames. All right, pretty impressive, huh?
Yeah, for sure. And that one battle, it's controlling the lake at that point, it almost reminded me of air superiority in World War II or in modern warfare, that if you could control the lake, you really could. That gave you such a huge advantage on the land campaign.
Yeah, you had a good supply line, and you could just do raids. You could just pop in at any place and surprise the enemy and burn things, which we've already seen. There's a lot of burning going on in 1813. But yeah, you've got to have the lakes. And this, I should say, too, you were asking me earlier about the blue water duels that we've been talking about, ship on ship. Those were mainly moral victories. I'm not saying they were completely useless, but here we have something that's much more than a moral victory. This is an actual, a complete dominance of Lake Erie, destruction of the British fleet, and control of the supply lines. That's big. That's much more than a moral victory.
Were those ships, those sloops and brigs, were they pretty much analogous to the ones that were on the open water, on the high seas?
Yeah, they're a little bit different, but they're similar in size and armament.
Now, talking about, we have a couple of naval battles under our belts. Tell us about another one of these big duels.
All right, yes. So let's go back out onto the open water and the blue water. In the fall of 1812, the U.S. frigate Essex, with 46 guns, had defeated the British brig Alert with 18 guns and had captured a troop transport with 160 soldiers en route to Canada. So that's kind of nice. That's 160 fewer soldiers that the Americans would have to fight. Then in either late 1812, like December, or very early 1813, the sources differ, the Essex captain David Porter decided to look for more prey, but this time in the Pacific. So here we go, Steve, the Pacific theater of the War of 1812. Sailing around Cape Horn, the Essex became the first American warship ever to enter the Pacific. And there, Captain Porter and the Essex spent over a year preying on British whale ships, taking prizes and living entirely off them. You know, it's good work if you can get it. Mm-hmm. By the end of 1813, the British Admiralty had had enough, and they sent a squadron of three ships commanded by James Hillier to find and destroy the Essex. Two of the ships, the Phoebe, which had roughly 50 guns, and the Cherub with about 26 guns, found the Essex at Valparaiso, Chile. The Phoebe docked next to the Essex in port, and at that time, the Essex could have destroyed her. But Admiral Porter, the American, decided to respect Chile's territorial waters and instead challenged Hillier to fight a duel at sea. Hillier refused the challenge and instead stayed outside the harbor, waiting for a chance to use both of his ships against his American opponent. So much for chivalry here, Steve.
Yeah.
We're fully on the chivalry stuff. We're done. You know, as I keep saying over and over, the enmity and the bad blood continues to grow throughout this conflict. We're not doing any more one-on-one challenges. We're just going to take you down. And on March 28, 1814, Porter finally decided to make a dash for the open ocean. His plans were destroyed and ruined when a sudden strong wind destroyed his topmast and forced him to seek shelter in a nearby bay. And despite the fact that the USS Essex was in Chilean waters, British Admiral Hilliard ordered the Phoebe and the Cherub to attack the Essex. After a tough battle, the Essex surrendered. Well, that's no fair. 2-on-1. Oh, well, all's fair in love and war.
Yeah.
Porter criticized the British for attacking while he was in Chilean waters. He also accused Captain Hilliard of continuing to fire on the Essex after he had surrendered. But Hilliard said, oh, that's just tough.
I mean, I think you can get yourself caught up that the Constitution took out, what was it, 4 British ships or something. But I mean, really, when you get down to brass tacks at this point, the Americans are the JV team playing a professional baseball team at this point. And you can't expect that every encounter is going to turn out as a miraculous win.
Exactly. Yeah, they had had some really surprising, shocking to the British victories in 1812, early 1813 on the open seas. But sooner or later, you're going to, the greater Navy is going to win. You know, it's kind of like, to use the football analogy again, it's like, let's say Alabama is playing, you know, I don't know, North Dakota State. I'm just making up a school. No offense to anybody at North Dakota State, but let's say Alabama is playing them.
We just lost all the North Dakota State fans.
Yeah, I'm sorry, folks. I love you. I have nothing against your college, but I mean, if you're going to play Alabama, you might end up being, say, 14-0 over Alabama after one quarter. But over time, it's very, very likely that Alabama is going to come back and win a decisive victory. So kind of the same dynamic here. The Americans knew this. The British were eventually going to win. So they were going to do as much damage as they could while they could.
That swings us back to the continental U.S. and more talk about the privateers. They get back into the game.
Yes. And we're also going to go a little bit over toward Great Britain as well. On August 14th, 1813, the British sloop Pelican defeated the U.S. brig Argus, which had 20 guns off the coast of Ireland. After this, the Navy Department ordered its smaller ships to limit themselves to commerce raiding. So now the Navy's starting to kind of rein in these gung-ho captains. On September 5th, the American brig Enterprise with 16 guns dueled the British sloop Boxer with 14 guns off the coast of Maine. After an hour-long exchange of broadsides, the Boxer surrendered. Both ship captains were killed in the battle. You didn't want to be a captain at this time, Steve. It's hazardous to your health.
Yeah, it sure is.
I mean, gosh, and a lot of other officers were killed as well in these battles, which I haven't even mentioned.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Text the word BATTLES, B-A-T-T-L-E-S, to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. Lily in Tennessee lost 42 pounds with Calitrin. Jeff in Indiana lost 55 pounds. Beth said her joint aches have eased up considerably and she is sleeping so much better. Text the word BATTLES, B-A-T-T-L-E-S, to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an amazing 86% success rate with their 90-day supply. And this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is so easy. Just text the word BATTLES, B-A-T-T-L-E-S, to 30605, and I'll send you a link to this special offer. You'll be glad you did.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
Meanwhile, American privateers had a tougher time in 1813 than they did in 1812, especially in the Atlantic, because British merchant vessels sailing there now sailed in convoys with warships protecting them, as I mentioned earlier. Privateers were mostly only able to get prizes in the Caribbean and around the British Isles because there British merchantmen sailed without escorts. And although privateers based on the Atlantic coast struggled, hundreds still operated out of Gulf Coast ports. By the fall of 1813, these privateers were taking up to 45 merchant vessels every month. So that's a lot of money. They're making a lot of money and hurting British trade big time. There's a few legendary or famous American privateers, which I want to mention. One of them was called the True-Blooded Yankee. I like that's a great name for a ship. 16 guns. This ship sailed around the British Isles for 37 days, capturing 27 prizes, occupying an Irish island for 6 days, and burning several British vessels in a Scottish harbor. They really punched above their weight class, didn't they, Scott? I'm sorry, Steve. I called you Scott.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that how effective they were.
Yeah, they just, you know, through ingenuity and speed and surprise and just, you know, don't be where the other ships are. Don't go where the British Navy is. You know the old saying in baseball, hit it where they ain't. So go where they ain't, if you'll pardon my grammar. Other highly successful privateers included the Scourge. That's an appropriate name, 15 guns. And the Rattlesnake, 16 guns, which together took 23 prizes in the North Sea and sent them to Norway, after which the Scourge took more prizes on her way home. Another, the Decatur, with only 7 guns, captured a British sloop by boarding. Now, that's gutsy. It's going to get a bunch of guys, pull over to the ship, jump onto the British ship, and take it over. That was a common tactic, as we've seen. The Lion captured 20 merchantmen. Lion is another ship. Captured 20 merchantmen in November alone and took $400,000 in hard money. We're talking gold and silver from a single British ship. Meanwhile, in Europe, the British war against Napoleon seemed to have turned in British favor with the defeat of the French in sight. And by the end of 1813, the British had already been diverting men and supplies to North America. So this is an ominous development for the Americans. For the Americans, time was running out.
I think that those privateers, they were really useful in the job that they were doing. And I think that it was a good strategy to just let them do what they do and not push them into roles like the U.S. did with the militia, and the roles that they just really weren't designed for.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Let them play their game, do their thing. Unlike militia, who were, as we've talked about before, militia were basically home guard. They were there to defend their homes and their cities and their towns against attack. The American government pushed these guys to march into Canada and attack a foreign country, and a lot of them didn't take kindly to it. The privateers, on the other hand, we don't see them being kind of pressed into the Navy. You know, congratulations, you're now a U.S. naval warship. The U.S. Navy didn't do that. They realized that their role of conducting economic warfare on the British was so much more important.
What did the Americans think when they found out that Napoleon had crashed and burned? I mean, that must have been a really grab your heart moment for them.
Yes, it was kind of this moment of ruh-roh, Rorge. Yeah, Napoleon had, of course, gone on this very ill-advised long attack into Russia, as most history fanatics know. Did not end well, ended up in the loss of the overwhelming majority of the Napoleonic army, which went back to Paris with its tail between its legs and with a lot fewer guys. And the allies that were working together against Napoleon were starting to close in on him. So, yeah, that's just the thing. One of the reasons that the Americans had been able to do as well as they had up to this point is because the British were so heavily occupied in Napoleon that the whole war in North America was a sideshow. It was just kind of an annoyance to the British. And now it's not going to be a sideshow. Now it's going to be the main war. And when you get the full weight of the British Army and Navy on you, especially if you're a young, fledgling, up-and-coming nation like the United States, you're going to be in trouble.
What were some of the political events and the economic activities that were going on as we get into the end of 1813 and going into 1814?
Yes, yeah, we do need to talk a little about politics and economics, although I much prefer military stuff. But you know, this stuff is going on at the same time as all these battles and these ship-on-ship combats and the actions of the privateers. So they're underpinning them. So as 1813 wore on, an increasing number of British newspapers and politicians began calling for peace. So the British people are very war-weary. They've been fighting Napoleon for a long time. They've been fighting France in general for a couple of decades off and on. And so they make their voice known. We're tired of war, whether it's against France or whether it's against the United States. And the government listened. On December 30th, 1813, a British truce ship arrived with good news. The British were willing to open peace negotiations. President Madison accepted the offer, and he nominated John Quincy Adams. Of course, he's by this time already a respected diplomat, the son of the second president, John Adams. Also, James Bayard and Henry Clay and Jonathan Russell and Albert Gallatin. They were going to represent the United States in the talks. Meanwhile, many of the U.S. volunteers' enlistments were soon to expire. As Donald Hickey writes, quote, "If Congress did not act, there was a real danger that the army would simply melt away," end quote. And so to attract more enlistments, Congress increased the enlistment bounty to $124, which is about $2,100 in today's money, give or take. They also offered $8 to anyone who would find a recruit. Congress also raised the authorized size of the army to 62,500. And to finance the war, Congress authorized the government to borrow $25 million and to issue $10 million in treasury notes. There was serious talk among the members of Congress about chartering a new national bank. Oh, no, not that. Yes, that. But opposition was too strong to make it happen. You know, the Republican Party, the Jeffersonian Party, the Party of Madison was still overwhelmingly dominating the Congress. And they just had this incredible bias against great big banks. So that doesn't work, although it would have been very helpful to the United States financial system. Now, there were Americans who were trading with the British, especially in New England, and they made a lot of money that way. Madison tried several measures to stop Americans from trading with the British, but the practice was simply too widespread for it to be totally eliminated. Now, one key measure that was passed to stop trading with the enemy was the Embargo Act of 1813, which was signed by Madison on December 17th. This was the most comprehensive embargo to that point in U.S. history. All American ships were forbidden to leave port and all exports were prohibited. The law made provision for strict enforcement with heavy penalties. But as you can imagine, this Embargo Act was extremely unpopular, and not just among Federalists, but even among some Republicans. In late March 1814, only about 3 months after it was passed, Congress repealed it at Madison's request. Congress also repealed the Non-Importation Act that had been passed in 1811. So yeah, it's interesting. They just keep trying these embargoes, these no export, no import rules, and they always end up getting canceled because they just don't work. And they just make people mad, especially the merchants that lived in the North.
Yeah, all of these economic sanctions, they just never, because there's always so many unintended consequences with them. Yeah, sure, it seems like a good idea. We put an embargo and that hurts Britain, but then they never seem to factor in the effect that it has on different parts of their own economy.
Right, yeah. So we're going to stick it to Britain. We're not going to sell them anything. And the people that used to do the selling are going, what about me? I'm going to lose my job. I mean, ports are shut down. They just didn't think it through. Seamen, sailors, merchant sailors go out of work. Unemployment rises. A lot of commercial activity grinds to a halt. And so, yeah, it doesn't work. It doesn't hurt Britain that much, if at all. Britain has plenty of other places to go for goods, and it just kills the American economy.
I mean, that's just the whole war is ill-conceived. People, it was a, nobody really wanted to do it. It was unpopular in England. It was, had some popularity here, but it wasn't super popular. It just seems like this is the point where people are maybe very sick of the war all around.
Absolutely. You know, you get so many have died, more died of disease even than died of bullets or cannonballs or anything like that. So yeah, a war weariness is developing on both sides. Whereas in early 1812, even in the spring, summer of 1812, there were so many that just were going to, they were gung-ho, we're going to teach Britain a lesson. That spirit is disappearing. All right, so that is the end of our discussion of 1813, at least 1813, on the seas. Previously, we talked about the land war in the north, and in our next episode, we're going to see what's going on in the south. The British and the Americans are both going to open up new campaigns in the southern United States, and we'll see if that does any good to either side.
Yeah, pack your bags. We're finally moving on.
Yeah, going to have a little bit warmer weather, more mosquitoes, more swamps and stuff like that. Sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah, I can't wait.
Get your boots on and strap on your musket, and we'll take you there next time. Join us then. Take care.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lim, Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen, and Vlogging Through History by Chris Mowry. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you could subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you could join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Anna Concepcion Castro, Brandon Cuckler, Mike Leslie, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabrese, Alex Coombs, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Mike Rollison, David Santee, and Michael Severino. And to Lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Roger Douglas, Scott Hendricks, Hoosier Daddy, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.